A jihadist mess in Pakistan, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Militants attack a police academy in Pakistan, and any number of extremist groups could be responsible.
It is now out of control. It's a Frankenstein, but it seems that Pakistan's intelligence service still thinks they can control them.
Also, we continue our special series on women in Pakistan. Today, the story of a child bride who's taking her life back into her own hands. Plus, why Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric doesn't faze some Muslim voters.
I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. He has given concrete solutions to real problems.
And singer Randy Newman's obsession with Vladimir Putin.
His whole macho thing is interesting to me.
Why do you find that interesting?
Because he's so powerful and he's part 15-year-old.
Those stories and more today on The World. Glad to have you here. A lot to get to today, including a hopeful story from Pakistan about a young woman who was forced into marriage as a child but still fought to finish her education.
If I think back now, I really wonder, how did I do it? Maybe I didn't know that it was hard. Nobody told me it's hard, so I just did it, you know?
The latest story in our new Across Women's Lives series is coming up later in the show. We begin, though, with decidedly less hopeful news from Pakistan, that overnight attack on a police academy in the city of Quetta. And at least 60 young cadets were killed in the assault. Kathy Gannon is covering the story for the Associated Press from Islamabad.
Well, what happened was three attackers went into this police academy where there were hundreds of police recruits who were unarmed because they're recruits, they're not trained police yet, they're cadets. And it was at night, so they would have been mostly asleep. And three suicide bombers went in. They all had suicide vests and they opened fire. There was a gun battle that lasted for 4 hours. One of them detonated his vest when the army arrived, and a second one went to detonate his vest, but before he could, he was shot, and then the third one was also shot. But that was after 4 hours. Now, we have two different claims of responsibility. One is the Islamic State. The second claim was from a very little-known group, the breakaway faction of the Tehrik-i-Taliban called the Hakimullah group. But most people who are familiar with the militancy here in Pakistan say that it's unlikely that that group would have the ability and organization to carry out such a coordinated and effective attack. But they have made the claim, as has the Islamic State. And again, there is no corroboration for either of those claims.
What does Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, believe? Who do they believe staged this?
The ISI hasn't made the comment, but the army has said that they believe it is Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which in the past has largely attacked minority Shiite groups. But again, it's still new. The situation, of course, as you could imagine, has been very fluid. So now the investigation really begins in earnest.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that just three attackers managed to engage this police academy in a firefight.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is very incredible. And the question is how is it that they're able to carry out such a powerful attack and cause so many deaths at a compound, a security force compound, whether it's cadets or whatever, it is still a Pakistan security force compound. And so there's a lot of questions being asked as to how they were able to breach the security, which seems to be relatively minimal because there were only a couple of guards. They shot them and then just came in.
Well, as you said, one of the claims of responsibility came from IS. It's been a couple of years since I first heard about ISIS getting a foothold in Afghanistan. How well established are they right now in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, yes. I think certainly in Afghanistan, they have a little bit more of a foothold. I think it would be a bit of an exaggeration to say they have a heavy-duty presence in both countries, but they certainly have in Afghanistan established themselves in eastern Afghanistan in Nangarhar province, which borders onto Pakistan. And some of Pakistan's tribal areas have not necessarily vowed allegiance to, but certainly indicated support for the Islamic State. But it's still unclear just how extensive their network is and whether it's more just people inspired by, would like to be affiliated with, as opposed to a real strong link with the ISIS or Islamic State in Syria and Iraq.
AP correspondent Kathy Gannon there in Islamabad. Pakistan is battling a number of militant groups, but some say there is another level to the problem.
The Pakistani military has tolerated the existence of certain militant groups that these Pakistani leaders believe can help them in countering India's military.
That's Reuters investigative reporter David Rode. He says the rise of extremists in Pakistan can be traced to the country's tensions with its neighbor and longtime rival, India.
There's a belief in some elements of the Pakistani military that the most effective way that Pakistan can deal with India, and they see India as its primary existential threat, is through militants, is through proxies. And they used that strategy in the 90s, but since 2001, the U.S. has tried to get them to realize you can't really divide militant groups up. There aren't sort of good jihadis and bad jihadis. They all tend to assist each other, but the military continues to pursue this strategy. You know, they see India as a bigger threat to Pakistan's future than these militant groups.
So there are no charges that India is kind of manipulating these extremists, is there?
No. I mean, that circulates as well in sort of conspiracy theories. But there's no question that this form of radical Islam, which, to be fair, the United States first fomented along with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, this jihadism in the 1980s, at that point to, you know, have young Afghans and Pakistanis kill Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan, it is now out of control. It's a Frankenstein. The U.S. has learned its lesson. There's debate about whether Saudi Arabia has learned its lesson about dealing with jihadis, but it seems that Pakistan's intelligence service still thinks they can control them.
This does seem to be an especially vulnerable moment for Pakistan. Can you tell us why that is?
There's been heightened tensions with India on the border. The army has sort of asserted, you know, tremendous control over the country. The new civilian government is fairly weak. And you do have these different groups almost competing with each other, these different militant groups for attention. And Islamic State has been gaining recruits in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. I was just speaking with an Afghan friend of mine who was in Kabul, and he talked about an attack that was carried out there by Islamic State sympathizers. And he was shocked at how young they were. So the traditional Taliban groups seem to be recruiting effectively among older people, but the Islamic State is making real inroads among young people who are apparently drawn to its even more radical approach.
How do you make sense of this kind of big tangle of different militant groups operating in Pakistan, sometimes working together, sometimes competing?
It's really disturbing, the splintering of these groups, and it makes it much harder for there to be any way to sort of crack down on them. And there tends to be this competition for which group will carry out the most spectacular attack. Pakistan might be trying to negotiate with some of these groups that it's had relationships with in the past in terms of encouraging some militants to battle India, but they're not going to be able to negotiate with all of them or crush all of them if they keep splintering.
Are ISIS and the Taliban actually working in tandem?
I think these groups all work together when it fits their needs. Mm. There's certain areas up in the tribal areas of Pakistan where they all seek shelter, and I think they will help each other there. But they're also opportunistic, and they'll recruit competitively and carry out different attacks.
Some of our listeners will remember that you were kidnapped by members of the Taliban while you were working in Afghanistan in 2008, taken across the border, held in Pakistan. How much have the networks of extremist groups in Pakistan changed since you were in captivity? Or do you think some of the same groups are still working just under different names?
It's my sense that the networks have splintered, that there's many different groups, there's many different Taliban factions, both Afghan Taliban and Pakistani Taliban. You have the Islamic State coming in, and then you have other militant groups that are sectarian, that just want to kill Shia Muslims, and others that just want to attack India. So I think it's gotten worse because there's so much more splintering, so many different groups, and it's that much harder to understand what's driving them or how to counter them.
So finally, David, I know this is a simple question with probably a very complex answer, I know, but what could bring meaningful change to Pakistan to diminish the strength of extremists there?
The most basic thing that could bring change and stability to Pakistan is more of a detente with India, lesser tensions, and then peace in Afghanistan. The Pakistani military is so powerful inside the country because it's able to constantly draw on this sense of insecurity in Pakistan that India is threatening it from the east, and there's also propaganda that India somehow controls the current Afghan government. So they'll back the Taliban, they'll back certain militant groups in the sense that they are saving Pakistan from the threat of India. If those tensions could come down, you would have a much healthier, growing Pakistan.
Reuters investigative reporter David Rode has been following developments in Pakistan. Thank you very much for your time, David.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Iraq and the battle over the country's second largest city, Mosul. The Iraqi army is pushing to take the city back from ISIS militants, but the extremists are resisting, and there are reports now that ISIS has been killing civilians in Mosul. It's difficult to verify those reports, but Patrick Osgood is trying. He's an editor for the Iraq Oil Report, based in nearby Erbil. Osgood says ISIS is starting to lose control of events inside Mosul.
We are seeing ISIS largely removed from the streets of the city as they've pulled people out to the fronts to mount defenses. The morality police, called the Hizbah, are being increasingly recruited to take part in offensives and take a more aggressive security role in the city. And that's rubbing up the wrong way with other ISIS recruits, and we're seeing gun battles inside the city. We're also seeing the Hizbah continue a campaign of vicious public executions. Because whereas they can't police the city effectively, they can try to instill fear in the civilian population there.
And how are you getting these details, Patrick? Who are sending these reports?
So we have a small network of Moslawis across most of the neighborhoods of the city.
Moslawis, those are the people who live in Mosul, correct?
Yes, yeah. Yes. They have communicated with us in a very simple way, you know, SMS and short phone calls and things. They're at a bit more liberty to speak from their homes now, firstly because the cell phone coverage throughout Mosul has vastly improved recently, and the Iraqi security services have worked with cell phone providers there to get free credit and provide numbers and provide information from the military on what citizens should do to minimize the risk to their lives as they wait to be liberated.
Yeah, what is the risk of reprisals from ISIS if they find out that these people in Mosul are sending details to Iraq Oil Report?
Death.
So that risk is still very alive right now.
ISIS has consistently severely punished people who are thought to be providing information to the outside world. And typically they make an example of them through executions, or people are taken to detention sites and never heard of again.
And so why are these people in Mosul doing this? Why are they sending you these details if the risk might be death?
Moslawis are generally, I think, very keen for the outside world to understand what's really happening. And they are incredibly brave. And it's a sort of testimony to them that we've maintained the same staff there for the entire period.
I mean, the first casualty, as we know, of war is truth. So with this assault on Mosul, a lot of verification is needed. How do you get that verification?
Well, we compare what we are doing with other networks of activists and journalists who are publishing through different outlets, mostly in Arabic. We try to verify some of the accounts that come in of airstrikes, for example, where the US-led coalition publishes daily strike reports. We take a look at those and see if they kind of line up. We've also worked with the same people for about 18 months, and we've developed a trust relationship with them. But make no mistake about it, we have to caveat what we do in Mosul because it does remain closed off to the outside world. But the importance of understanding what's happening inside that city outweighs the kind of doubt that we might have about, you know, a specific set of particulars of a specific report about something. The general trend that comes out from our reporting, I think, reflects what people are saying elsewhere. And what we've seen consistently is things that we have picked up on very early through our network have then started to percolate out as other journalists have interviewed people who have managed to escape the city.
Patrick Osgood edits and reports for Iraq Oil Report. He spoke with us from Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. Patrick, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Still ahead, why treasure hunting on the beach in Rio isn't so good this year. That's coming up here on The World. We're hearing a lot these days about the big changes at the North and South Poles as the ice caps there start to melt under rising global temperatures. What we hear a lot less about are the risks that scientists take in trying to understand these changes. We've just gotten a stark reminder of those risks with the death of Gordon Hamilton. Hamilton was a glaciologist at the University of Maine who died over the weekend when his snowmobile plunged into a crevasse on a glacier in Antarctica. We here at The World first met Gordon Hamilton earlier this year when our own Ari Daniel traveled to Greenland to report on his climate research there. What do we know exactly about what happened to Gordon Hamilton?
Well, Marco, Gordon was in Antarctica on a field expedition. His team was developing these kind of special robots to study the stability of a part of the ice shelf down there that is riddled with crevasses. These are cracks that go down really deep into the underlying snow and ice. In fact, Gordon told me once that you could drop a handful of school buses down into a typical crevasse without making a dent. That's how big these things are. And this past Saturday, according to the National Science Foundation, during a trip that Gordon was making in a snowmobile, he toppled into one of these crevasses, and the accident was fatal.
So he died in Antarctica, but you spent a week with him on a glacier in Greenland. I'd like us to hear some tape that you recorded. This is Gordon Hamilton. You can really feel that sense of excitement and amazement about the part of the world he worked in.
I mean, look at this landscape. It's just, you can't take your eyes off it. It's gorgeous.
The blues that you get in glacier ice are quite something. This really iridescent blue color, something unlike that you ever see anywhere else. And it's something that just drags your eye to it and holds your focus.
I remember one of the evenings when I was up in Greenland with Gordon, and I turned around and noticed that he was walking away from the campsite. And within just a few minutes, he'd gotten his way to the top of this giant mound of snow and rock. And he perched up there for a while, just looking out at this massive glacier that was sitting in front of us. And he was utterly transfixed, totally in his element.
I'm very fortunate to have a job that allows me to work with a great group of colleagues and travel to amazing parts of the world where most people will never get a chance to visit.
I'm lucky that I got to see one of those places, Marco, and that I had Gordon as my guide.
Yeah, I'll say. It does take a lot of dedication and a lot of bravery to work in extreme settings like Antarctica. How do you think Gordon Hamilton balanced the risks against the rewards?
Well, I think that scientists who work in these regions have to take on a certain level of risk in order to extract data from these parts of the world that are telling us something about our changing planet. Gordon's work really focused on understanding the role that glaciers play when it comes to the climate. He studied how glaciers are changing in terms of their size, their flow speeds, and their behavior, and then what those changes could mean for the rest of us as glacial ice finds its way into the ocean.
Greenland, if it were to melt completely, would raise sea levels by about 7 meters worldwide, to our 21 feet. Antarctica, 55 meters. Not that we think that it's all going to melt completely, but let's say we got a meter of sea level rise in the coming century. That would be a huge deal for societies to have to deal with, and it's well within the range of possibilities.
Yeah, that does seem to be the bottom line here. The risks are worth a better understanding of climate change. We've been speaking about glaciologist Gordon Hamilton, who died this past weekend on a research trip to Antarctica. Ari Daniel, thank you very much for sharing your memories of Professor Hamilton and his work.
My pleasure.
You can read some of Ari's stories featuring Gordon Hamilton's work in Greenland there at PRI.org. Even after summer is over, a lot of people like to take a stroll on the beach, and at least some of them do it using a metal detector. You know what I'm talking about. Treasure hunters looking for loose coins, lost jewelry, things like that. Along the beaches in Brazil, this sort of hobby is almost a profession. The World's Will Carlos has a story about Rio de Janeiro's urban gold miners.
It's a stunning late spring dawn on the beach in Rio de Janeiro's Barra da Tijuca neighborhood. It's that time of year when the currents change and the winter beach erodes and flattens out. And it's this changing season that has brought Rio's garimpeiros, literally gold miners, out to Barra. Like Oswaldo Pintos de Oliveira. We call this urban gold mining, he says.
Ouro, prata.
We find gold, silver, coins, money, watches, electronics, GoPro cameras, glasses. Oliveira is a deeply tanned 52-year-old from Copacabana. He's been combing the beaches of Rio for nearly 18 years. He and his fellow garimpeiros employ different tactics depending on the day. If it's rough like today, they use a special tool, a rapina. It's shaped like those long-handled nets used to fish leaves out of a pool, except it has a scoop at the end with sharp, curved teeth, like a mini backhoe bucket. Oliveira describes how he pushes the rapina into the soft, wet sand, lets it fill up, and then holds it in the breaking waves to wash away everything except shells, trash, and treasure. Often there's nothing worthwhile there, but sometimes the ocean is generous. Oliveira says he's found two gold Rolex watches over the years, worth thousands of dollars each, even if they have to be melted down. Most days, he says he finds a gram or two of gold, worth about $30 a gram. And every time he sees that glint, he says, it's a serious rush. But some of the older treasure hunters say pickings are getting slimmer these days. Back in the 1980s, there was more jewelry on the beaches, more watches, they say. One of the reasons is Rio's stubborn crime rate. People are scared to wear any jewelry on certain beaches in Brazil, Oliveira says. In recent years, Rio's famous Ipanema beach and others have been hit by mass robberies, where a line of thieves works their way down the beach, holding up everybody and stealing everything of value. A mile or so down the beach, Evandro Nunes isn't buying into the idea that there's less treasure to be found these days. Nah, he says, that's not it. There are just more gold miners now. Maybe you used to have 10 or 12 of us. Well, now there are 60 or 70. So while you used to find 10 pieces of jewelry, now maybe you'll find two, because there are just so many people doing this. That's why Nunez and his friend have wandered further away from the main crowd of treasure hunters. Nunez plunges his rapina into the sand, then braces as a wave smacks against him. He tilts the bucket, letting the sand drain out with the rushing water. Then he reaches into it and holds up a thin, gleaming ring. Already, I say? On my first pass, he says. A little gold ring. Look at that. For the world, Will Carlos, on the beach in Rio de Janeiro.
You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a child bride in Pakistan remembers her wedding day.
I closed my room and I cried a lot, and I told myself that this is all you're gonna cry in the rest of your life.
Now she's taking back her life. Her story is part of our series on women, American money, and Pakistan. Hashtag balance of power. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Child marriage is still a painful reality for millions of young girls around the globe, especially in places like Pakistan, where each year, poverty and cultural norms force thousands of young girls out of school and into arranged marriages. All this week, our Across Women's Lives team is reporting from Pakistan, exploring how U.S. foreign aid to the country tries to improve the lives of adolescent girls there. It's part of a series we're calling Balance of Power. Today, The World's Carolyn Beeler brings us a story of a young woman who was forced to marry at 17, but somehow found a way to take her life back into her own hands.
This is what Ume Salma remembers about her wedding day.
Before I started to dress up, I closed my room. And I cried a lot, and I told myself that this is all you're gonna cry in the rest of your life.
The groom was 26. Salma was 17. She was transformed from an overachieving 10th grader into a bride terrified of what would happen on her wedding night.
I was not educated about the subject even, so I was really scared of him coming in the room. So I went to the washroom and I locked myself up. And now I look back at it and I think, how many more girls out there they would have experienced the same feeling?
1 in 5 girls today in Pakistan gets married by the age of 18. Many are poor. They get pregnant quickly, drop out of school, and pass their fate along to their daughters. But Salma's family isn't poor, and this is not that story. Salma's marriage was arranged to help her family win allies in a generations-old dispute. Salma agreed to the arranged marriage only after her husband's family promised that she could stay in school. And she did, even after getting pregnant at 17.
I remember I would climb 4 stories with the swollen belly and all. And it was hard. If I think back now, I really wonder how did I do it. Maybe I didn't know that it was hard. Nobody told me it's hard. So I just did it, you know.
But Salma's husband didn't like her career ambitions. They split about a year ago. Salma is 23 now, confident and practical with a wide smile. Her 5-year-old daughter, Umaima, lives with Salma's mother now, at the family's home in a dusty small town about 4 hours from Lahore. Salma moved away for school years ago and just got her engineering degree from a top-notch university in Islamabad.
Bhaage, bhaage, run, 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 main count kar rahi hu.
Salma visits her daughter when she can, about every other weekend.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. No?
They sit together for a bit, and then Umaima gets up to tear around the house and courtyard, sandals slapping against the stone floor. Juggling single parenting and career ambitions is not easy for Salma. Sometimes Umaima doesn't even call her mom. She uses the Urdu word for older sister.
Obviously, I miss her a lot, and she misses me as well. But I think eventually, in a couple of years, we'll be staying together. So probably we'll make up for it. But it's hard, you know. But you have to do it sometimes.
Salma just got an engineering job with a big oil and gas company. Soon, she'll be spending 3 weeks a month working on an oil rig in southeastern Pakistan.
I had to do this, you know, because it's eventually where I want to be and where I want my daughter to be. This is, I think, the sacrifice time for both of us.
Sacrifice. It's a subject a girl married off at age 17 knows all too well. I sat down with Salma's mother, Shafkat Munir, to ask how she feels now about asking her daughter to make that sacrifice.
Do you ever feel guilt or sadness about Umi's marriage?
I feel so.
Sitting side by side on the couch, Salma translates for her mother.
So she thinks that if I had not the added responsibilities of marriage and children, then maybe I would have been able to excel more. So this makes her feel guilty sometimes.
Munir says she felt forced into marrying off her daughter to help settle a dispute with another family. She doesn't know if she'd do it again.
It depends. Depends ke Allah ta'ala Allah kare us tarah ke halaat dobara na ho.
She hopes that she never has to face the same circumstance ever again.
The child marriage rate in Pakistan has dropped by half in the past 2 decades. Sindh, the country's largest province, recently raised the legal age of marriage from 16 to 18. A similar law was proposed at the national level, but was thrown out after being deemed un-Islamic. Advocates say the toughest part of reducing child marriage rates is changing attitudes about the practice. But that's the very thing Salma has managed to do in her family.
17.
Salma was 17 when she got married.
Same. 17.
So was her mother. But the granddaughter in the family?
No, 17.
Not 17, Grandma says.
She really wishes and hopes that she goes farther than what I did, and she not only makes a name for herself, but be a strong person.
For now, Umaima is just a 5-year-old playing on the swing set with mom, making the most of the time they do have together.
The World's Carolyn Beeler reporting there from Pakistan. And Carolyn joins us now on the line from Islamabad. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi, Marco.
So I got to say, Umi Salma seems like a really remarkable young woman, but clearly it's not an easy road to get to where she is. Is it fair to assume that this is not typical of how cases of child marriage work out in Pakistan?
That's definitely fair, Marco. Typically, if you get married when you're young here, you are married into your husband's family. The opportunities for education and career are very slim. Ume had to really fight to make that happen for her. And this sort of is borne out in a really surprising statistic that I read the other day, which is that 57% of women who are married in Pakistan have never set foot in a school room.
So what is the U.S. government doing about the problem of child marriage in Pakistan?
Well, I was digging around into that and looking into what the U.S. government is doing because they recently released this report in 2016 called the U.S. Global Strategy to Empower Adolescent Girls. The U.S. is paying a lot more attention to adolescent girls lately. And in that report, they called child marriage a human rights abuse and made reducing early and forced marriage a key goal. But I was surprised to find out that USAID, the big development arm of the U.S. government, doesn't have any programs that are explicitly focused at changing attitudes about child marriage or trying to reduce child marriage as sort of a primary goal.
So not a single program. Why is that?
Well, I asked USAID about this, and they didn't give me a straight-on answer. They said that they do incorporate anti-child marriage programming into other components of their programming, including education and community awareness, economic development. And one of the big things that they are doing that might move the needle on this is last October, Michelle Obama announced this $70 million joint initiative called Let Girls Learn in Pakistan. And so the government says that this is a good way to try to prevent child marriage. But in talking to some folks here on the ground, they say that education is helpful, but it's not the whole solution. So I spoke to Anis Jalani, who's a child rights lawyer in Islamabad, and I asked him, you know, will just boosting girls' education work to stop child marriage?
Of course not. You know, child marriage is a complicated problem in Pakistan. It's a customary issue. It has religious connotations. Education is only one way to handle it, but it's not the only way.
And by that, he meant it's not a silver bullet. It can't be the only solution because then it won't work.
So do you have a sense of why this practice of girls getting married at a young age is so entrenched in Pakistan?
I think part of it is traditional. As you heard in the story, Ume's mother got married at 17, and she did as well. But a lot of it is cultural and has links to Islam. As I mentioned in the story, there was a law that was proposed to try to raise the age of marriage for girls to 18, and that was thrown out. And I spoke to Marvi Memon, who was the legislator who introduced this bill. And she said that she had to sort of drop it right away when it was labeled something called potentially blasphemous by an Islamic body that sort of looks at legislation and decides if it's appropriate or not.
When the word potential blasphemy comes up, any sane legislator backs away because I intend doing politics for the rest of my life. And if you've got this stigma of potentially having committed blasphemy, you can't really work.
And that was Marvi Memon, who's a legislator who we're actually going to hear a lot more from in a piece tomorrow.
Carolyn, just one thing quickly on your story. I'm curious to know, how hard was it for Umi to separate from her husband?
You know, I asked her about this, and she didn't want to talk a lot about her separation. I think it was painful, and it is not a common thing to happen in Pakistan. She's actually not legally divorced. She is separated. So that might hint at the gray area that is happening right now.
All right, we'll leave it there today. The World's Carolyn Bila reporting in Pakistan this week for our Balance of Power series looking at how U.S. foreign policy impacts women around the globe. Carolyn, thanks a lot. Looking forward to hearing more.
Thanks, Marco.
Okay, so the U.S. government spends on average about $1 billion a year on gender programs around the globe, which is why we're asking you this question. If you had $1 billion to help women in your country, what would you do? You can tweet us your answer at Women's Lives using hashtag Balance of Power. We also put that same question to ninth graders at Lawrence High School here in Massachusetts. And I'm in the studio with the world's Isis Madrid and Maria Muriel from our Across Women's Lives project. So Isis, why did you want to do this at Lawrence High?
I personally wanted to reach out to young girls of color who maybe don't have access to this kind of education in their day-to-day schooling. Lawrence, Massachusetts, it's called the immigrant city here in Massachusetts, so it was the perfect place.
So, Maria, what did you do there?
So we worked with the United Nations Association of Greater Boston to write this whole curriculum for the students, all based on our Across Women's Lives reporting. And then we went to the school and we took over Mr. Hicks' AP Human Geography class. It was a co-ed class. There was also boys there.
But. Yeah, it was boys and girls. And we broke up the class into 9 groups, and each of the groups representing a different country, like total like model UN style, like you see on TV.
Right.
I was like geeking out.
They were so into it.
Yeah, they loved it. And the kids were representing Colombia and Pakistan, which are countries that we actually have reporters in right now. And we're, as you just heard,
right.
You know, airing stories on child marriage. And this is the stuff that the kids were talking about. And it was just so exciting. And they loved it.
So you recorded some of this. What are we going to hear, Maria?
So we're going to hear their discussion with the UN moderator talking about which initiative is best to fix. So they had to pick between whether to end violence against women, increase literacy and education for women, or encourage women in leadership. And so we're going to start with the Columbia group and what they thought was most important.
Ending violence against women and girls. We see it as the most important because there's too many girls in Colombia being abused sexually and they don't speak up.
Which did you pick for Pakistan?
End violence against women and girls. Even though like literacy and like education was really bad in Pakistan, there's like children, like little girls, like marrying in Pakistan, so we chose that.
Are you ready out here?
Yes.
Okay, we're back on. Thank you.
Fellow delegates, we are the delegates of Algeria.
We, the country of Algeria, believes that the most effective foreign policy strategy is an increase in literacy and education for girls.
The country of the Philippines believe that the most effective foreign policy strategy is to increase literacy education for women.
The most effective foreign policy strategy is to encourage women's leadership in peace and security.
To end violence against women and girls.
To encourage women's leadership in peace and security.
To end violence against women and girls.
To encourage women's leadership in peace and security.
To add more laws for women's safety and end violence against women and girls.
Thank you.
And I'd like to hear more about the challenges that you saw.
I feel that since the leadership, it ties in with education, if we teach girls more about how to deal with those kind of situations, the crime rate will go down, they'll speak out more, and the leadership will go up.
I think like the best solution would be is to end violence against women, because once they feel safe to talk, once they feel like they can go to other people and tell them what's happening, I feel like that will increase their literacy and like increase leadership.
I'm not saying that the strategy of ending violence is bad. I think that ending violence and encouraging leadership go hand in hand, because when you encourage leadership, then the woman will encourage people to stop violence. Take like now in the United States, like if Hillary becomes president, that will encourage like young girls to be like, oh, she can do this, that means that I can do this, like being like the president of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, with 2 for ending violence against women and girls, 3 to encourage women's leadership in peace and security, and 4 to increase literacy education for girls, the straw poll recommendation of this committee is indeed to increase literacy education for girls. Give yourselves a round of applause.
The voices there of some students at Lawrence High School just outside Boston weighing in on the best foreign policy strategy that would help raise the status of women around the globe. Some really great answers there.
These kids are my jam.
My favorite was this kid named Lewis. I think he was
Sweden,
right?
Yeah.
He came up to Maria and I at the end of the class and he had a book. And he was really proud of it. And he was like, hey, I got this book at a yard sale this weekend, because we had gone a week earlier to do prep. So they were like deep in these issues already.
What was the book?
It was called 200 Women, I think.
Yeah, and it was about like important, historic, powerful women throughout history. And he was like, I was just really inspired.
That's fantastic.
And then he told us to stay fresh. So yeah. I'd like to say, Lewis, you stay fresh too.
Stay fresh, kid.
Speaking of staying fresh, it seems like this project could be reproduced in many other schools.
Yeah, absolutely. We've actually made this curriculum open source. So it's on PRI.org/womenslives. If you are a teacher, this is up to Common Core standards. Or you can just do it with a community group or with your friends.
With your kids.
Check it out. The Balance of Power curriculum available for download at PRI.org/womenslives. The World's Isis Madrid and Maria Muriel, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Coming up in a few minutes, singer Randy Newman talks about one of his latest obsessions, Russian President Vladimir Putin. First, though, a quick story about the election, our election. My BBC colleague Seema Kotecha is in Florida to report on the race, and she's been asking some American Muslims for their take on the campaign's heated rhetoric.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
That was Donald Trump back in December. His critics call those remarks divisive, racist, and reprehensible. His supporters say he is full of good ideas.
He has divided the nation. I have friends, they are afraid to go out in the public. It's really, really disheartening to see that.
Tahsin Siddiqui is 34 and a Muslim. She says Trump's words have wounded her deeply. At this Islamic center on the outskirts of Miami, she and many of her friends believe that he is fueling Islamophobia.
It's not just Muslims that he had gone after. He had gone after the Mexicans. He has gone after the women. He has gone after, like, all the other minorities. So this is, like, racism, and the hatred is on another level.
But there are some Muslims here who believe he is the right man for the top job because they say causing offence is less important than stopping terrorism.
Hi, my name is Yasser Belou, and I've been a Republican ever since I've voted in this country, and this year is going to be no different. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. What distinguishes his candidacy is he has given concrete solutions to real problems. Americans are really afraid. Americans are really angry about ongoing terrorism. There's not a solution that Hillary Clinton has come up with and says, okay, this is the solution on how we should control domestic terrorism.
So do you think stopping Muslims from coming into the country is a good idea?
No, of course not. But I have to be able to be comfortable in my heart with the decisions I make, and that's what I am.
Muslims only make up about 1% of the US population, but many live in strategic battleground states like here in Florida. And that's why campaigners say their vote really does matter. Yasser Belou says that a vote for Clinton is asking for more of the same.
President Obama, in his 7.5 years of presidency, has killed more Muslims, including innocent civilians, by drone and by other methods. So comparing Donald Trump's rhetoric to actions, I don't think it's a choice.
Yasser Belou ending that report there from the BBC, Seema Kotecha in Florida. The start of this new song by Randy Newman sounds a lot like the ominous beginning to Citizen Kane. The video to the song also begins in a similar way. It pans up to reveal not the Kane mansion, but the Kremlin. The song is called Putin.
Putin putting his pants on one leg at a time. Me is just like a regular fella. There ain't nothing like a regular fella.
Randy Newman wrote Putin before the allegations started surfacing about Russia trying to hack the U.S. election and before all the talk about a bromance between the Russian president and Donald Trump. What inspired Newman was the news a few years ago that a Russian motorcycle gang called the Night Wolves, well, has got a friend in Putin.
It's that little thing with the nationalist motorcycle gang. His whole macho thing is interesting to me. He's sort of... He's got some teenager in him, which is really interesting.
Why do you find that interesting?
Because he's so powerful and he's part 15-year-old.
You kind of look at Putin from a couple of different points of view, the kind of narrator in the song. Who is kind of giving these appreciations of Putin in your song?
There's somebody, this voice is correcting him when he says he's just like a regular fella, huh? You know, the old saying about putting your pants on one leg at a time, you know, like they do it in sports where they say he's just like you and me in that he puts his pants on one leg at a time.
Yeah, the name Putin kind of allows you to play around with the word put a little bit.
Yeah, Putin. So that's how I started it. There was an old song, gospel song called Stalin Wasn't Stalin. And I got the idea, I think, directly from that.
Actually, we have that queued up. Let's just hear the first verse of that.
Oh, sure.
Well, now Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land. So he called the Yanks and English and proceeded to extinguish the Fuhrer and his vermin. This is how it all began. Now the devil...
It's a great song, isn't it?
It's really great. Kind of good old wartime propaganda. How did you first learn about this? How did you first learn about this song?
I heard it on a gospel album. It's beautiful lyric, English and extinguish and German vermin, you know.
The last time you came out with your kind of political dukes up, it was the wonderful and sober tune of Few Words in Defense of Our Country, a kind of general skewering of American exceptionalism and some of the leaders who came up during the Bush administration. Do you see your song Putin as perhaps a few words warning our country? Do you worry about what Putin means for the future of the U.S.?
Yeah, I worry about him having most probably some kind of a stake in our election, you know, some interest in it, a foreign power. That's really, really weird. I mean, that's unprecedented. I don't know whether that's happened before. And he doesn't wish us well. There's a reason that he's for Mr. Trump, you know. It would be chaos, I think, probably.
Maybe you need to write an addendum verse at some point.
No, I mean, when I looked at the video they made, it does the lyric fairly faithfully. It's not like there's some sympathy for Putin in there. He says, I can't do it, and the girls tell him he can do it. Certainly, it's not all evil Putin in the song.
Right.
He may well be that, but his people, I think, probably genuinely believe that he's for them, that he would like Russia to have hegemony in the world.
Randy Newman, I got to say, your gift of satire in music is pretty rare. And the last artist I can think of who really had it was Tom Lehrer. Who do you look for inspiration when it comes to talking about really big world issues in a few verses?
Songs?
Yeah.
There aren't many people that choose to write songs like that, like Putin, for instance, or like most of my repertoire. But Tom Lehrer was tremendous. I love him. I like making people laugh, and so did he.
Randy Newman there, and here's a little bit more of his song, Putin.
Oh, wait a minute, even better, what if the Kurds got in the way? Hey, Kurds and wait, Kurds and wait. Sometimes a people is greater than their leader. Germany, Kentucky, France.
You can see the just-released video for Putin over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.